Welcome to Drinking Bros, presented by GhostBed.com. Sit back, relax, and grab a fucking drink.
Life on the front lines requires you to step up your game. Owned and operated by former Navy SEAL Sean Mattson, CardoMax has designed just the right supplements for you and is offering Drinking Bros an exclusive offer. Buy one, get one free on your first order. Go to CardoMax.com and use the promo code DB. That's CardoMax.com, helping you achieve your max. Welcome to Drinking Bros, kids. Awesome, awesome show today. We have one of our favorite authors of all time. I think you and I, Dan, we can collectively agree that this is one of our all-time faves.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, just the not just the body of work, but the content itself has been very good. I'm a social psychology fan, obviously. I like to think about how other people think. Because it's, you know, the Socratic method. You do that enough and you can start making predictions about what's going to happen. And that helps you in life, right?
Absolutely. And I think Malcolm Gladwell is one of the very best to do it. Welcome, Malcolm. Where are you at today?
I'm in Manhattan.
Manhattan. Oh, boy. Sorry. We've had a lot of guests in Manhattan, and they're not amped about it these days.
I was going to say not Manhattan, Kansas.
Yeah.
Manhattan. We have to remember there's more than one Manhattan, and it's, you know, people very arrogantly assume when they say Manhattan that everyone knows they're in New York.
I'm not sure how arrogant that is. Nobody gives a shit about Manhattan, Kansas.
I think K-State is there. Isn't K-State there in Manhattan?
I don't know.
I think it is. Yeah. I think it is.
It is. It is. I know you're a huge sports fan, which we'll get to that a little bit later on. I want to talk about the 10,000 hours thing. I'm sure everybody drills you about this, and this is kind of one of the biggest topics, you know, because you invented it essentially. And I was in an interview, and this is a full disclosure to you. I want to share it with you. I was in an interview, and somebody had asked me about because I love writing. I finally hit the New York Times bestseller list with a book one time, and the interviewer had said, you know, do you feel like you earned it or whatever it was? And I go, man, that Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours bullshit was a lie. It was way more than 10,000 hours to get there. And then he flipped it on me, and I thought this was really interesting. And he goes, do you think the fact that Malcolm even just put that number out there made you at least work toward it, and you accidentally became a master of the craft because there was a number and a goal for you to work towards to get to being a master of your craft? And I had never thought about it that way. I was curious if you did, because once he said it, it really hit home, and I was like, shit, you're right. Yes, that's probably exactly what was going on all throughout all the 10,000 hours and everything else, and it worked, but just it took me longer.
Yeah, it's about instructing people to be patient, you know, to use, since we're all sports fans here. I always think about this. You know, everyone always says they observe of young point guards who come into the NBA. Mm-hmm. You know, simultaneously, everyone always says takes a long time to be a really good point guard. And then they'll observe a guy who's been drafted who is disappointing after the first year, and they'll call him a draft bust. And it's because they refuse to internalize this fact that is such a demanding, difficult, you know, job that you can't master it. These kids are 19 years old. Like, there's no 19, you know, one in 100 19-year-olds can play point guard in the NBA at a high level in their first year. Everyone else has got to put in their time. And, you know, it's gotten more difficult now that kids are coming out of college even younger and younger, if going to college at all. So it's like, why do we have to keep reminding ourselves that difficult things take time, right? Nobody, if your doctor said, I skipped my residency, I came straight out of medical school, and I really like to do brain surgery on you, you would say, that's crazy, and you would run from the room, right? We have no problem when it comes to doctors.
For sure.
It's true of a lot of things.
For sure. Yeah, I think even when Altucher talks about skipping the line, his latest book, and some people might see it as a refutation of what you've written, but I don't think so, because he just talks about spending that time becoming a generalist, not necessarily spending the time learning one specific skill. He learned this variety of skills, and then you could skip these lines for sure, but you still have to learn all these skills, right? There's still work to be done, I guess, is the phrase I would say. And there's actually your point guard analogy. There's a recent example of that. Chris Paul is leading a team. Look, DeAndre Ayton is good, really good. He's going to be an all-star pretty soon. Devin Booker already an all-star.
Yeah.
But it's not like they have a dream team over there, but they are killing it with a 35-year-old point guard, which seems weird, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Because everybody thought Chris Paul was done 2 years ago. And now this guy's the leader on a team that is the number one team in that in the Western Conference, which is, you know, despite the injuries of the Lakers, still a very competitive conference, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's so I'm just trying to validate you. I know you need a lot of validation, Malcolm, so I'm here for you.
I'll validate you on that water choice. I caught that Spindrift, bro. I'm about that life as well. That's my go-to water. I'm not a LaCroix boy. I'm all Spindrift over here.
Well,
on this
side. All my mixers in my bar at home are all Spindrift because they got the best flavors for sure.
God loves Spindrift.
Absolutely. Yeah, best in the biz. Best in the biz. Somebody like you, which is interesting, is again, like Dan was saying, you're one of the greatest writers of all time. You don't really look like a sports guy. However, a lot of what you write about is in relation to sports. I know you do a lot of work with ESPN. Mm. Did you grow up playing sports at all? What was this love of sports that drove you into this? Because there's a lot of references towards sports in a lot of your writing.
I still am a runner, really serious runner. In fact, this 27-year-old friend of mine, so understand that that's someone who's less than half my age, challenged me to a mile race in 3 weeks. So I'm really, all I'm doing right now is not even promoting my new book. I'm just in training for this race. But no, I was a very serious runner as a kid, still am a serious runner. And once you get engrossed in one sport in a serious way, you suddenly have a whole new respect for all sports. You know, it's like, I have never played a round of golf in my life, but I watch every major because I understand, just as someone who runs, I understand that what they're doing is insanely hard. Mm-hmm. And that's incredibly. Same with, I never picked up a basketball in my life. I am an NBA nut, just because I understand that these guys are unreal, right? Mm-hmm. You appreciate that. I don't think if I wasn't an athlete, I wouldn't have that same appreciation.
Yeah, that makes sense. And, you know, even because Dan and I, you know, we host a big sports show and we try to cover all of the events live to get the appreciation for these athletes up close and personal. Because we have a gambling sponsor that goes along with it. And so when we give picks, I genuinely feel bad if I got it wrong. So, for example, Dan and I just got back from the Kentucky Derby. We were there on Saturday. I picked Bob Baffert's horse because Bob Baffert just does not lose. And me and my friends won a ton of money that day. And it was great. But the appreciation for these horses and these trainers and these jockeys up close, when you're able to see it that close and personal, it's wild. I mean, and these horses are beautiful. Do you even get down on the Kentucky Derby? Did you watch it on Saturday?
No, I don't. I have to keep my sports obsession pretty tightly reined in, or I would do no other. I wouldn't do anything else. So I discipline myself. It's NFL, it's NBA, it's running, it's golf majors, it's tennis majors. That's about as far as I go. I can't. I don't. I mean, you start adding baseball into the mix, all of a sudden, your entire life is just evaporating.
Especially up in New York, there's two teams really close by, and it would just consume all. And look, to be honest, those two New York teams are very frustrating lately. We had a guy from Barstool on the other day, Kevin Clancy, and he's a Jets fan, a Mets fan, and who was the other one?
Knicks.
Yeah, Jets, Mets,
oh,
Mets,
man,
Knicks.
Why doesn't he just, that's he should been, just shoot himself? Yeah,
exactly,
like, why would he do that?
Yeah. We put him in therapy. As soon as you said that, we signed him up for therapy, because fuck that, all of that.
Yeah, I mean, don't need any of that.
Although the Knicks are starting to turn it around a little bit. We'll see. The Mets, maybe.
Yeah, we'll find out.
Probably not with that ownership group, but who cares?
We'll find out. Who's your go-to teams that you're following right now?
Well, you know, I'm Canadian, so I should be a Raptors fan, and I'm ashamed to say that I'm not as much of a Raptors fan as I should be. I just like basketball, like follow the sport. I don't really follow a team. And my NBA, I'm a Buffalo Bills fan, of course, because they're the closest, or NFL rather, they're the closest football team to Toronto. And I have been in the wilderness for 20 years, and I'm out, baby. I'm back. I'm like, I have, as of last season, I have a new lease on life. So this is, of course, a great joy. And, you know, if you had said to me that Josh Allen would be leading me to the promised land, I would have said, you're crazy. But it turns out he is.
Yeah. I called it. I called it on the show. That was the year that the Baker Mayfield draft, too. And every Cleveland fan jumped down my throat when I said, take Josh Allen over Baker Mayfield for the long run. And it looks like he's going to do it. I actually, that was my dark horse last year. I actually threw a grand on it privately before the season started. And they got real close. That Kansas City game hurt. That wasn't close at all. But I think that kid and that organization are definitely headed in the right direction. Mm-hmm. And who wants to party more than Bills fans? Let's be honest about it. You ever been thrown through a table?
No, I saw that. I saw that. I saw that their draft pick jump through a table. I was like, dude, what are you doing? You're like, that's your body is your livelihood. Are you crazy?
Yeah, leave that shit to the fans, man. Jesus Christ. They did. But the Bills have for the last 4 or 5 years had the best overall pass rush in the NFL, and they spent their first two draft picks on edge rushers.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they're really trying. I think that's a good thing. If you're able, I think Altshuler actually mentioned this in his book as well, not to keep blowing up your spot here with Altshuler's book, but he talks about if you can take one of your elements from good to great, rather than create two new good ones, something like that, you should take that one from good to great because it'll make you stand out, right?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I think that's what they're trying to, they're really trying to beef up that defense and make it crazy, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I love what they're doing up there. That Bills team and the fan base is so great up there.
It's the best. Like,
everybody loves the fan. They've never had a bad reputation ever.
Yeah.
Not like, you know, certain New York teams like to throw batteries at people and shit like that.
Buffalo's just Buffalo.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
you throw a dildo at Tom Brady on the field. It's just Buffalo, you know?
Yeah.
You're like, that's a Buffalo fan. No big deal. I want to pivot here and talk about your book, The Bomber Mafia. When we were flying back from Louisville yesterday, Dan didn't say two words to me because he was face down in this thing, and it was the last one on the stand there. So you had sold out in the Louisville airport, and I know you were wondering. I know you were wondering. Dan bought the last copy there. So
yeah, he tracks all the airports.
I do. Because I used to look for my own in airports, and if it wasn't there, I'd pop one in there and just leave it because the barcodes are the same, and nobody knows. So I was just like, all right, great. I'm going to put that in there. He bought the last one yesterday at the Louisville airport. What made you want to write this one in particular?
Well, my dad grew up in England during the war, and he grew up in Kent, which was flyover for the German bombers coming to hit London during the Blitz. And so I grew up on stories about Second World War and stories about my dad hiding under his bed and the unexploded bomb that landed in my grandparents' backyard. Mm-hmm. And so it was just like, which if you're a 6-year-old boy and your dad's telling you those stories, it sounds like the coolest thing that could ever happen. I've been a military kind of buff for my entire life, but I've never found a story I wanted to tell. And then I sort of stumbled on this. I was spending all this time with Air Force guys, and I just kind of stumbled onto this world that was centered around Maxwell Air Force Base in Montgomery, Alabama in the 30s. And it was so magical and so strange. And the thing about Maxwell is that they have all of this archival, they have these incredible archives where they have taped interviews with every single major Air Force figure from the 30s on. And, you know, I wanted, this book was an audiobook first. You know, we created the audiobook and then the print book is a spinoff. And I just realized, oh my goodness, I can tell a story here. I've got all this tape. I can bring this history to life and I can explore this weird thing about these pilots who thought they could, this called the Bomber Mafia, who thought they could reinvent war and how they almost pulled it off.
Yeah, this is, I gotta be honest, it seemed, I'm not taken aback, but I was surprised to see you writing a book about military shit right, but I like your work. So I'm like, all right, cool, I'm going to read this. I read the whole book last night on the plane in about 2.5 hours, I think. This is the best book I've ever read dealing with the social psychology surrounding military leadership, especially. Like, it's not even close. This is one of the, this is actually one of my top five favorite books right now.
Thank you.
It's incredible. Now, I was, if you don't know, I was a sergeant in the 82nd Airborne in the infantry back in the day during the Iraq War. So I've got plenty of combat and plenty of combat leadership experience. This is brilliantly written. I mean, it's the research you did is great. The way that you animate the mindset of the commanders on the ground, both their flaws and their strengths and things like that, and then wrap it up in a narrative that still leaves some questions to be answered at the end and leaves room for conversation, is one of the best pieces of work that I've ever seen. So I really appreciate you writing this. And I think our fans who are primarily military and first responder will really enjoy this one.
Yeah. I got to say, you know, when I was doing this book, I hung out a lot with Air Force leadership, with both the outgoing and the incoming chief of staff of the Air Force. And I came away with this with such respect for that institution, to the point, I forget whether I tell the story or not in the book, but I was watching, you know, in the middle of the pandemic, they changed the leadership of the Air Force. The General Goldfein retired, and they brought in this guy, General Brown. And I watched the whole ceremony online, and I was in tears by the end because it was so dignified and so, I mean, all of the speeches everyone gave were fantastic. It was, you know, the first African-American chief of staff of the Air Force in the Air Force's history. It was, nobody talked to me. It was the middle of that, you know, last summer was crazy on so many levels. No one talked about politics, not a single word. It was about serving your country, building a strong institution to defend our country against our enemies, about giving opportunities to people who, you know, want to do that, make that sacrifice. I mean, it was just like, it was so beautiful. And I thought, if I can do nothing else with this book, I'd like to capture some of that spirit that these people who are, who built the Air Force, who made it what it was, what it is, are people who were motivated by something more than, you know, the desire to win wars. They were motivated by bigger,
right,
moral things, bigger, and that was beautiful to me.
Right. I mean, even in the book, you talk about Curtis LeMay, who would be seen as an empiricist or a pragmatist or whatever, and in wartime that can seem particularly brutal, right? And can rub some people the wrong way. But the fact that during that first napalm run that they did, he stood on the runway and waited for the planes to get back. When you walk into his home years later, it wasn't pictures of awards or all the famous people he met, but it was the last picture of his bomber group together, right? Because he wanted to remember the men that served under him. So that's to me, I was that kind of leader, frankly, and I know the depth of emotion that goes into that, but the fact that you were responsible for masking that emotion in real time and dealing with it later on, I'm sure it was great stress on this man, because he, let's be frank, aside from what happened with the Enola Gay, he's probably singularly most responsible for ending the Pacific conflict as soon as possible, right? But despite the brutality, and it's, you know, there's one thing we've always said in the military is we have to be brutal and monstrous sometimes so our civilians and children have the luxury of being thoughtful and kind. You know what I mean? War is not pretty. And even fucking Mr. Miyagi said it right. Yeah. Don't fight, but if must fight, when, right?
Yeah.
Like there's no, you know, you can't, we have all these aphorisms like you can't steal first or second with your foot on first. Nobody's ever won trying not to lose. But for some reason in war, we feel like we can be a kinder, gentler version of our former selves and win. No, war is the it has to be the last possible option. Mm-hmm. And once you reach that option, it has to be over as soon as possible. That's just how it is, in my opinion.
I think one of the things that struck me in writing this book, well, you know, I'm talking about this group of Air Force officers in the Second World War. And when you really delve into their stories and their histories, you're reminded of just how impossible war is. Mm. I mean, I was just, you know, here are these guys. I was just, the thing that, there was one speech this guy gives, and he's talking about how much stress they're under. and you realize these guys are going up every day sometimes doing these, you know, you go on this bombing run that might be 8 hours, it might be longer. You're getting fired at. You don't know whether you're going to come back. The odds are you won't come back. You come back and you grab whatever sleep you can, and you go up again. And then maybe you lose on one bombing run. You lose 5, 10, 15, 20 guys who you were friends with. And they get replaced by someone. And then you lose a whole nother set the next time you go up. And like the kind of strain that these people are under. There was one thing that Curtis LeMay says when he was in Europe. And you realize, I realized that I read somewhere that, oh, he talks about it, how when you lose men on a bombing mission, you have to write their families.
Yeah.
So when you come home from a bombing mission and you've lost 100 men, that means you have to write 100 letters. That's just crazy. Can you imagine 100 meaningful letters? I knew your son.
Yeah.
And he served honorably, blah, 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 you know. Just like, that's just unimaginable to me.
Yeah, it's not like you're going down to CVS and getting thank you cards for the quinceanera. Like, I mean, you know, they're personal. And aren't they hand-delivered, if I'm not mistaken, too?
Yeah, they're typically hand-delivered by a morale officer of some sort. It depends on the branch of service. But, yeah, typically the chaplain and an officer will deliver those letters. It changed in Vietnam, actually. They started sending them by telegram. Which, yeah, exactly. Like, and typically they would just leave them on the doorstep or whatever the fuck. I mean, it was, but we can talk about that another time.
That's brutal.
Like, it's good to go back and look at these books because it teaches us a couple lessons. One, it teaches us the brutality and sacrifice of warfare, but the cost teaches you two things. It teaches you that we have to take care of these people once they're done, but it also teaches you that we can't fucking walk into conflict all willy-nilly like we want to do these days. Everybody wants to be a fucking tough guy and shit. If you want to be a tough guy politician, why don't you put some gear on and go over there and fight?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Because all we have in office these days are fucking draft dodgers, to be honest. So I have a great disdain for politicians. I'm not trying to drag you into political shit, but that's it's the lesson. I go back and watch World War II documentaries all the time to remind myself that nothing that we will ever do will be as important as what those guys did. And the reminder is that if we have to fight again, it has to be something like that. It has to be something that is a legit existential threat to liberty, right? To liberty and humanity before we can fight at that level. Because the next, what's the quote? I don't know what weapons will be used to fight World War III, but World War IV will be fought with sticks and stones. You know what I mean? We can't fucking keep tiptoeing into conflict like this and thinking it's going to be okay. It's not.
Yeah, and the interesting thing I found on your book, because after I was able to pry it out of Dan's hands this afternoon, and I got through about half of it, is the other important reminder in a book like this, when you're going back to the 30s, is leadership actually never changes. You always need great leaders, and you always need to learn about different types of leadership, because no one ever made it on their own without somebody else's advice or reading somebody else's stories to help get to where they were. And the fact that the leadership, no matter what the technology is, leaders, true leaders and leadership has not changed. How would you relate that to the other books that you have written thus far as leadership goes and the leadership role?
Yeah, it's funny. You know, I've never done something that was as in-depth into, this book is really about two men, Haywood Hansel and Curtis LeMay, and two of the great generals of, Air Force generals of the Second World War. Usually in my books, you know, I tell lots of different stories that come together thematically. So I've never devoted a whole book to understanding the psychology of two people. And also, never devoted a book to understanding the psychology of two people under these kinds of conditions, you know, because the thing about it is I'm not writing about peacetime leadership. I'm writing about guys who, like we've said, they're in the thick of it and they're being asked to do something that is, you know, when both of these men are asked to do something that is basically impossible, which is to fly from Guam to Japan and bring Japan to its knees from the air,
right,
using, you know, either conventional explosives or napalm. Mm. You try doing that. I mean, it's insane. The weather alone, like you're flying, like you're not flying modern aircraft. You're flying 1940s aircraft over 1500 miles of open water in some of the most treacherous weather in the world.
I mean, through the jet stream, which we didn't even know existed at the time, by the way.
Yeah, they don't realize that over Japan, there are 200 mile an hour winds.
Yeah.
And if you, and when you're coming back, like, they don't have all this fancy navigational GPS, whatever. They're trying to fly back to two little specks in the ocean. And if they miss them or run out of fuel or any of those things, they ditch into the ocean and no one ever finds them. Mm. Right? It's just like, it's crazy. And then before LeMay gets to Guam, he's in India, in Calcutta. And they're trying to hit Japan from Calcutta. And all you have to do, if you want to understand how crazy that is look at a map. Because you know what's between those two places? The Himalayas, the tallest mountain range in the world.
Right.
They would climb over the Himalayas, lose insane numbers of planes, climb down, land in China, refuel, fly to Japan, turn around, come back, and then climb back over the Himalayas. I mean, it's like, I met a guy, I forget where, I was on out somewhere, and I was talking to a guy, and he's like, oh, I was telling him the story. He goes, oh, my dad was one of those pilots who flew over the Himalayas. And it's like, he never expected to survive the war. I mean, no expectation whatsoever. It's like, Jesus, like, it's just crazy. These stories are insane.
These stories, these stories are insane. And I'm wondering, have you heard from any of the family members who read this, you know, your book and said, oh, I didn't know this about my grandfather or my great grandfather, or thank you for doing this? Because, I mean, a guy like you, let's face it, you're pretty much a Bible author at this point, which means, you know, you sell as many copies as the Bible around the world whenever you put out a new book. And you can kind of do whatever you want. And it's amazing. The fact that you chose to do this story, did any of the family members reach out and be like, man, thank you for doing this. This is incredible. I didn't know this.
It's starting to trickle in. So the book's only been out a week, so it's early yet. But I got a text this morning from a friend of mine whose father's a pilot and from a family of Air Force family. And he said, he listened to the audiobook. He's like, I listened to it twice. And they just said, I listened to it twice. Thank you. And that's all I needed to hear. It's clearly, you're absolutely right. If you have family who went through this experience, hearing these stories, it resonates, but it does more than it resonates because, you know, it reminds you about what your own family did for this country.
Right.
Right. That's the thing, that someone in your family made a sacrifice. A serious sacrifice. And, you know, sacrifice is not a word that I believe has been uttered in the United States in the last 25 years. In fact, I don't even think it's in the dictionary anymore in the United States, but there was a time when it was in the dictionary. And this is about that time, right? When that's what you did. You're 20, some of these guys are 20 years old.
Yeah.
And they're just going. So I am starting to hear from people who genuinely, I think, are touched by the fact that the sacrifice of their family is being remembered.
Right. And I think you'll probably hear from more people. This is specific to a certain group of people, but the story or the concept is not. I mean, there's a lot of people who have done this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
One of the things I like to do is I talked about the World War II thing, reading and watching those films and documentaries, but I like to meditate sometimes on what those bombers were thinking when they left for those operations, or what Medal of Honor recipients and other people like that were thinking when they just decided to walk into near certain death and why they did it. I like to consider what those people might expect of me as a survivor or recipient of that sacrifice, and how they might expect me to live my life. You know what I mean? If they were still around, a lot of them aren't. It's good to appreciate and honor sacrifice, but it's more important, in my opinion, to meet the expectations that are implicit in that sacrifice, which is to be a good human being, right?
Mm-hmm.
Support your country, even if it means calling your country an asshole sometimes, whatever the case is, right? Think about the mindset of dying for people you don't know, right? Because you believe in the principles of a country that says individual liberty is the most important thing in the world, right? So what are you doing to support that? Not only legally or politically or any of that bullshit, but what are you doing to make sure that everybody around you has the same access to that you do, right?
Right.
We spend, like you said, sacrifice is a word that's not really around much anymore, but goddamn, it'd be nice if it was.
And it still exists every day, all over the world. It's still going on. You know, obviously, Dan was in the military. I have a Hollywood background. I want to ask you what your agent said to you during this pitch of, here's my next book. Because I went through it with a military book, and I have to imagine, he said, why do you want to do this? Why the fuck do you want to do this? Because you have your pick of writing anything in the world.
I didn't ask my agent. I started a audio company 2 years ago with my best friend, Jacob Westbrook, called Pushkin Industries. And we just made this. We do our own stuff now. So we decided to do we thought there was an incredible audiobook to be done here. We made it. And then we just took that audiobook to publishers and said, you want to make a print version? It's all yours. Like, you know, let's make a deal. So there was no, I went outside the normal. My appetite for the old way of doing things is diminished. I think I don't want to deal with intermediaries anymore. I want to do my own thing.
Yeah.
I want to do it. And, you know, there's a certain point when, and I know you guys must feel the same way, when you just, when all that matters is autonomy, is deciding when you're going to work, how you're going to work, where you're going to work, what you're going to say, and not have somebody looking over their shoulder. And that's what I'm into right now. And my next book is, I already know what it is. It's totally different. It's like, so I'm going off on it's not a kind of book I've ever written before either. I'm doing whatever comes to mind right now.
This is the exact answer I was hoping for, because it's exactly what we are doing here. So we own a media company and we own about 12 or 13 shows. My books, the last couple, you know, I got away from the publishers as well, saying, all right, we have this platform. I can put out my own books. I can put out my own audiobooks. Do you have to go through Audible on this? And do they take a huge percentage on that? Because we just uploaded ourselves. Are you doing the same thing at your media company?
We did two things. So you can go to bombermafia.com and download it, and we'll get 90% of the proceeds. Or you can buy it on Audible, and we'll get less, because Audible obviously has a takes a big chunk, and they do a lot of marketing and such. I think in the future, there's going to be five different ways to get a book. I don't think, at this point, I don't really care. I think we should give the public 10 different ways to enjoy it and pick the one that works for you and go with it. It's funny, but I don't think of if you listen to people in the media world are all obsessed with these distinctions between various kinds of media, but listeners, they just want to be entertained or educated. And whether that comes from a podcast or an audiobook or a book or whatever, I don't think they're making those distinctions. And that goes with my new kind of philosophy, which is why are people sweating about all these different distinctions? Just do cool stuff and people will tune in, you know?
Yeah. I mean, we're in a creator economy and that's what people expect now.
Malcolm, you've done a ton of podcasts. Obviously, we have some sponsors put the shit wagon on the air. First and foremost is ghostbed.com/drinking bros. Rich Bernstein from Ghostbed's coming in the office in a couple weeks.
Oh, word?
Yeah.
Big fan of Rich.
Love those guys. Love the Ghostbed. 30% off everything in the entire store. Pillows, sheets, mattresses, adjustable bases. You name it, they got it at ghostbed.com/drinking bros. And I think, D'Anthony, I think that base is 40% off.
Yeah, it sure is. Yeah.
Ooh. Head on over there now. Best in the biz. I'm trying to get the new mattress from them here as soon as I get a move-in date at my house when they're all fixed up. A lot of people, my buddy just ordered that Matrix one, that 3D Matrix one.
Oh, word.
I've not had it yet.
No, we need to rest our dick on one of those pretty soon.
Yes, dude.
Rich.
Come on, Rich.
I mean, no big deal, but
we need to know about the products, bed, Rich. Man,
come on.
But my buddy just sort of said it was like the greatest. So I'm gonna look into that whenever my move-in date is and try to get one of those guys resting in the old master. Go to ghostbed.com/drinkingbros today, where, as always, they got a 36-month pay-as-you-go program at no interest there. And while you're there, you can couple all of those deals together with the 36-month pay-as-you-go program. Walk out of the store with somewhere in the $35 a month range for a whole new bedroom set. And it's fantastic, man. A good night's sleep is important. Next up, we've got Capsule.com. Mm-hmm.
It's another good company, and one that I'm just a big fan of in general. But certainly now, these days, after all the pandemic nonsense and the shutdowns, switching everything to working at home and telemedicine actually has made my life a whole lot easier. Now, it used to be relatively common that you would get like an IV company to come over to you, pay an expensive premium for it. You could get, and Amazon's gotten big over the last few years, especially, you can get everything delivered. Why are we still going into doctor's offices, and why are we still going to pharmacies?
I don't know.
It is ridiculous.
Yes.
That we're still wasting our time doing that bullshit. All we have is time. Like, that's the only resource you can never make more of.
Mm-hmm.
Get rid of all this wasted time in your life. Start getting more efficient. Run your prescriptions through Capsule. That's what I'm doing.
And Capsule is a new kind of pharmacy that hand delivers your prescription the same day for free. Here's how Capsule works. It's super easy to start. Visit capsule.com. It only takes about 15 seconds to sign up. When your prescription is ready, Capsule will text you to schedule free delivery at a time you choose. That's important because that's your choice. So when you want it, boom, you can get it. Then a Capsule courier hand delivers your medication to your door straight from their pharmacy in a tamper-proof package. It's totally secure. And if you have any questions, you can call, text, or email with an expert pharmacist. It's that simple. No more waiting in line. No more driving to the pharmacy. No more forgetting refills. Best of all, even though it's a way better experience, Capsule doesn't cost any more than your old pharmacy, and that's important. Also, it's in Austin here, and I had it shipped to my office one day. Mm-hmm. So they're able to come to your office if you're at work or whatever. Capsule accepts all major insurances and is currently available in New York City and the surrounding tri-state area, Austin, Boston, Chicago, the Twin Cities, in LA, and then there's a bunch of other cities that are coming soon. To sign up, visit capsule.com to get your prescription hand delivered today for free. That's capsule.com. We've been talking about gambling on this show today as well, Dan. And
isn't necessarily an ad. It's just, we did talk about sports with Malcolm a little bit today, and he's a huge sports fan. He's standing by to hear more of this. But we're going to run a promotion on MyBookie soon. We've been doing a lot of gambling lately.
Yes.
You guys have been doing a lot of gambling, so we're going to give you a little reward on the 10th of May, 5:10. There's going to be a promotional thing that we run, and it's not available yet, so we're not going to tell you what it is exactly, but there will be a promotional thing we run, and basically you get a free $10 bet on whatever you want.
Anything. Right? Anything. You're going to get an extra $10.
Yeah.
Because you've been going hard as well as I have, and I talked about it because I want to understand the psychology of gambling a little bit more and what I did over the last year and everything else, and it only takes one to win. And that happened to me on Saturday at the Kentucky Derby. So that's going to be a fun thing that my bookie is going to have out there soon.
People expect autonomy. This is not new, by the way. In politics, the name of the game for years was to be genuine, right?
Mm-hmm.
To make people believe that I'm a regular guy. Obviously, no one's believed that for a very long time,
right?
Because Ivy League educated billionaires are running for office and shit like that. Like, all right, cool guy. Nice blue jeans, but get fucked, right? Yeah, we don't believe any of that shit. But authenticity is really important in delivering a message. It really is.
Yeah.
And the autonomy is the only way you can get there. It's
because
otherwise people are like, oh, you're having to do this for this. And that's why we're very honest with the listeners. When we have a sponsor we have some kind of conflict with, like they have a problem with me with us saying something or with something else going on, I'll just tell them to leave because I don't give a fuck about the money, right?
Yeah,
that's not. We don't care about that shit. We can make money doing anything.
But yeah,
but if you like start to bend your narratives to meet that, that's then you get cable news, right?
Yeah,
and nobody wants that shit.
Nobody wants that, and to hear that a guy like Malcolm Gladwell is doing it on his own will now encourage everybody else to do it on their own. Because that's what I get that message every day from somebody saying, man, I want to write a book. I need to get an agent. I need to send in a query letter, whatever. And I was like, actually, you don't have to. And the best of the best is telling you right now to do it on your own, keep your own rights, because you have the power and the capability to upload it and get it out to whoever you want. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And with an audiobook, what I'm curious is, because I've never done this, but I've seen the numbers over the years. So over the last 8-9 years, I've noticed that the audiobook is starting to sell more than the actual hardbacks themselves, because people want to get it in an audio medium, and they also want to hear the writers themselves read their own books. With you, how do you write a book this complicated and this complex for just audio and not for hardback? That's a difficult one.
You always have to have the hardback available, probably.
But
you can. It's a question of how you start it. So, with my last book, Talking to Strangers, I sold more. I have sold way more audiobooks than I have hardcovers. So that was an eye opener for me. And I did it. I didn't just read it into the microphone. I produced it like a podcast, like a narrative, like an audio documentary. I had all of the tape of everyone I interviewed. I had archival tape. I had scoring it. And we did the same thing with this book. And what it changes is it changes how you write it, because you're thinking about the listening experience. And you're thinking about, I can describe this guy, Curtis LeMay, and I'm going to let you hear him. And if you hear his voice, you get an insight into who he is and the decisions he makes in a way I could never explain to you on the page.
Right.
So it changes the story I'm writing a little bit, but also it gives you way more freedom, because audio, as you know, we're all in the audio business. Audio, I can distribute for nothing online to anyone in the world, right? So all of a sudden, the minute I think of this as an audio product first, not only do I think it's a better story, but it gives me more and my audience way, way more freedom.
Yeah.
I don't need a printer. I don't need a bookseller. I don't need Amazon. I don't need paper. I don't need any of that stuff, right?
Yeah.
And that insight, that was the insight that started our company, which was audio can make us free, right? And once I realized, it took me a while to realize that. Once I realized that, I was like, oh, I'm gonna tell stories from now on, because that's free. Like, that frees up me. It's and that, you know, that I no longer think of myself as a print first writer. I'm audio first writer.
Well, I mean, I think it's like the difference between a script and a screenplay, right? Almost.
Yeah.
Like it elucidates so much more. It activates on the most important, in my opinion, the most important principle in writing, which is theater of the mind. Like, when you say the word chair, we all have our own version of what a chair is, right? But the more context you give the reader, the more influence you can have over the theater of the mind. Letting them hear the way Curtis LeMay talks, for example, just the audio of an interview will change their opinion of the man immediately, right? Even if they don't realize it's happening, it changes their opinion of the man immediately. Hearing him say his own words in his own tone completely changes everything.
Absolutely, because we only read this in print, so I haven't gotten to hear the audiobook yet. I didn't. I was unaware of that. And we had Matthew McConaughey on a couple months ago with his book, and I told the audience the same thing. I'd read the book, and then I'd listened to the audiobook. Hearing Matthew McConaughey read his own book exactly like you wanted him to read it, man, was just a lights-out experience, and it was my favorite audiobook of last year. The fact that you were able to integrate real interviews into your audiobook, now I have to get the audiobook tonight. Like, that's my next, you know.
Click. So proud of it. I mean, we spent, let's be clear, we spent probably $200,000 and 5-6 months making the audiobook. I mean, it's not a trivial undertaking, but we think it's worth it just because of that. It's like, if I can put you inside a B-29 flying over Europe in 1943 and put you in the head of some of those kids inside that plane, that is an amazing experience.
Yeah, it's really? If maybe somebody should build a theme park where you can get in a B-29 and look down through a telescope at the ground and try to find targets. That'd be interesting.
Yeah.
But this isn't, this technology isn't that old, by the way. I mean, there used to be, even in the C-130, there were tubes that people looked down through to see if there were people firing or looking, aiming RPGs at you when you were flying low and shit like that. That was happening in the late 90s, early 2000s. So all this fancy stuff is relatively new.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that would be a great theme park.
What? You just came up with this great idea. You want to give it away to someone else? This should be your next business. Let's go. Yeah, you're already in Texas. It should be in Texas.
That's what I always do. I always come up with business ideas and just like crowdsource. Like, somebody make this because I want to experience it, but I don't want to do any of that shit.
Yeah, yeah. Some of the legwork on these ideas, we're like, you can take that. The other ones we'll do on our own. Stick to what you know. You know, we're a show called Drinking Bros. We have a hard seltzer coming out this fall. So we stick to what we know. And then audio, obviously, is unbelievably fascinating. And I know you've done a million podcasts and everything else. These fiction podcasts, have you guys started working on those at all?
Yeah, we tried a little experiment with it, and we'll probably go back to that. But so far, our specialty are these produced narrative podcasts, like my podcast, Revisionist History, where we're doing 10 episodes a year and taking 6 months to produce them. So that's our little niche. Mm-hmm. It just so happens that we have a lot of people who love doing that kind of thing. We may branch out, but it's like, you know, we've just really, and that's what we enjoy. I have a bunch of people who love, who love just burying themselves in research for 6 months and, you know, seeing what we come up with. So, we're open. I mean, we're up to 50, my company's 50 some odd people now. So we're growing fast enough that maybe someday we'll add that arm.
Yeah, because we're about the same now. Close to 20 that we have here. We have two history podcasts on our network, Softcore History, and then another show called Iconoblast. It takes them hours because of the research on that. When you're doing a historical podcast, because if you miss, the audience is going to hammer you and absolutely come down your throat and be like, that never happened. You know, 100% of the shots you miss, you don't take, was not John Wilkes Booth.
No, it was Michael Scott quoting Wayne Gretzky.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the bitch of these history podcasts where you're like, man, there's so much research. I mean, God bless those guys doing it, but zero interest in that kind of research.
You make one error, they will jump. I won't tell you what it is. There is one very, very, very trivial error in my book that my one serious pilot friend was like, I need to alert you to a line on page, blah, 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 where, and I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe I made a mistake. Now every serious Air Force guy is going to be like, I like it. They're going to come to that one sentence.
Yep.
And they're going to say, oh my God, what's he talking about?
Yeah.
It's the worst.
It'll live with you forever. I had it on a book where I named one character was in West Virginia and they were like, that wasn't a state until the year after. They only called it West Virginia as a nickname. It wasn't officially. And I'm like, God damn it, man. It was a 500, you know, like that's the one thing you found. And when we had Michael Irvin on the podcast last week, he had 200. And,
you had Michael Irvin on your podcast last week?
Oh, it was the best.
He told
all of the stories. Stories where he was like telling his cousins to shut the door.
Yeah. Like his wife's in the other room and he's whispering like, dude, you know, we're on like television right now. Right?
Yeah. But the most interesting thing that I took away from it was, he was sitting behind him was like Super Bowl trophies, Emmys, you know, MVP, you name it was back there. And the only thing he thinks about was dropping this one play against Deion Sanders in a game where he had 220 yards and like 13 catches.
It was the record for an NFC championship game.
But all he talks about is that one mistake, and that's what will live with you forever.
Well, that's another thing that LeMay animated too, I believe, or that you animated about LeMay, is that of all the success he had. Look, he, again, one of the most influential single people in all of U.S. military history. Not just because of what he did, because of when he did it and what the circumstances were. But what he remembered years later were the losses and not the victories, right? Mm-hmm. This is how it works.
Yeah.
That's how you get to great
greatness, and anything in life.
Yeah.
Was there something like that in your life where you made a colossal mistake that at the time you were like, shit, but it led to something else?
Probably. I mean, I got fired from my first job, and at the time, I was 20 years old. I just got out of college, and I got a job. I was in Canada, and I got a job in the United States, and I thought, this is my little magazine in Bloomington, Indiana. And I thought, this is my ticket to becoming a journalist, to living in the United States, all things I wanted to be. I got fired after 4 months. And I was like, I blew it. This is my chance. And I blew it. I was inconsolable. I remember, I had a Chevy Cavalier with all my stuff in it. I drove from Bloomington to Washington, D.C. And I basically cried the entire way. Because I was like, this is my shot. You know, I got to go back to Canada and become a, you know, real estate agent or whatever I was going to become. And luckily it didn't turn out that way. But yeah, there have been moments where I've just thought, oh, like, it's weird. It's never as bad as you think it is in the moment. There's this wonderful concept that I love in psychology, which is called affective forecasting, which is how good are we at forecasting how we will feel in the future? And the thing about human beings is we are terrible affective forecasters. So if you win $1 million in the lottery and I say, how will you feel a year from now? You will say, I'll feel fantastic. Truth is, you won't. Or the other thing is, and this happened to me, someone you love dies and I ask you, how long will it take to recover? And you'll say, I don't think I can ever recover. And the truth is, you will. You're not in that moment, you are not good at forecasting how you'll feel down the road. You know, my dad died yet a couple of years ago. And if you would ask me the day he died, how long I would take to get over it, I would have told you I will never get over it.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a tendency to catastrophize, right, as human beings for whatever reason, particularly lately.
Yeah.
The more, and it's a function of society, the more we've all heard hard times make hard men make soft times make soft men, that whole thing. Mm-hmm. But it is real. When people stop having to activate on Maslow, they start looking inward. And look, man, that's a problem. Because we're good at seeking out patterns, but we're also we're very bad at distinguishing between a real pattern and a fake pattern sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And we see these things in ourselves and we're like, oh, man, I should be paying attention to that. No, you really shouldn't. You shouldn't. And everything becomes emotional reasoning after that, and that we are in the depths of emotional reasoning right now, and it is nonsense. Go ahead.
We're also really bad. I mean, the other part of that is closely tied to that is we're also really bad at making predictions. This is a thing that I always come back to, like that story I told about effective forecasting. Mm-hmm. One is that, to your point, when emotions are involved, we get all messed up really fast. The other thing is every human being thinks they know how, where they'll be or how they'll be or how someone else is going to be a year from now. And the truth is we do not know that. I always laugh. I think of this every year around NFL draft time, because I read all these draft predictions and think of those draft predictions is that 75% of them are wrong.
Mm-hmm.
They have no fucking clue. Are you trying to tell me you can look in the middle of COVID, you can look at an 18-year-old who's played like four games in the last 2 years,
right,
and you can project how good of an NFL lineman he's going to be? No, you cannot. That is nonsense. You should just, there are six guys in that draft who you can confidently say they're going to work out, mm-hmm, and they're probably not the guys you think. And everyone else, it's a crapshoot. Mm-hmm. Do I have any idea how good a quarterback Mac Jones is? No, and nor does anyone else. No clue, right?
Yeah.
And like, you could go down that list. These guys, some of these kids have played a season and a half of college football.
Pick three.
Are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah, Trey Lance didn't even play a season and a half. He played a season, right?
I think he only threw 318 passes total, and then he was out with COVID.
That's a light year in the NFL for a quarterback.
I thought I saw that. The Niners taking Trey Lance was, I will say it right now, I'm not going to say it's dumb, because if I say it's dumb, then I'm saying I know.
Right.
Right.
I don't know. I will say that is the riskiest thing that I have seen in years at the top of the NFL draft.
Do you think that's riskier than the Bengals not drafting an offensive lineman to protect Joe Burrow, who seemed like a sure thing before he went down in like game seven? You know what I mean? And which we predicted, by the way. So we were pretty good at predicting that. Because
you went 9 for 9. The Trey Lance thing, I did not. I had that wrong. I was so shocked. Because we were doing a live show. I threw my headphones off and I was like, I can't believe they just did that. Yes, in my mind, that is the riskiest pick, maybe top five ever, simply because he threw 300 passes at a D2 school that no one has ever seen, played. They don't have any competition. And he sat out an entire year with COVID.
But what are accurate predictors of success for a quarterback in the NFL? What are KPIs for that? Because it's not college success. Because the best college quarterbacks rarely ever do well in the NFL, right? Because it's a different game.
Yeah.
So it's got to be mindset and skills. But how do you, man, if anybody could figure out how to predict how a certain mindset was, one, going to work in an environment, and two, going to develop as time goes on, then you've got the fucking $1 billion solution right there. You've won at life because you can do anything with that information forever.
What was your reaction when you saw it live?
Well, I couldn't. Everything that you just described, plus the fact that they traded up for this.
Yeah. They did not need to do that.
Not only did they take an incredible risk, they gambled the future of the franchise before they took that incredible risk. Right. Like, and then Mac Jones falls to, what did he fall to, 15?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
If Mac to Jones Patriots, is going to be sitting around at 15, like, why are you trading up? You're trading up for the kid who threw 300 passes? Like, it's just, the whole thing made no sense to me. I think those guys are really high in their own supply. That is the biggest danger. When you're convinced you're some kind of genius in the NFL, in personnel, there's no such thing as a genius. Everyone is just guessing. Mm-hmm. And the smart people are the ones who guess the most, who say, I'm going to need 40 guesses to get 10 right.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Give themselves, that's what smart means. It does not mean that you can limit yourself to 10 guesses and expect to go 10 out of 10. It's
crazy. And for me personally, like as a Falcons fan, which is already brutal enough.
Why would you do that?
I denounced all of my Atlanta. I'm from Atlanta. I denounced all of my Atlanta teams on. And then I said I wouldn't wear their memorabilia anymore. Nothing except for draft day, because that is the one day of hope for every single fan out in America. And everybody asked me on every show, they said, who do you want the Falcons to take? My only can't miss prospect in the draft for me personally was Kyle Pitts. That guy looks like a once in a generation type tight end. And I said, I don't want a quarterback. I think Matt Ryan can still play a couple more years. Just take Kyle Pitts. That is the safest pick you can make. And no one is going to come after you if that's a bomb. Because everybody thought that was the guy. Him and Trevor Lawrence were can't miss prospects. So I'm okay with that. And that goes back to your theory of just do make the best, smartest decisions you can. And then hope, right. Now, the Trey Lance thing was such a far out guess that it's either he'll either be the biggest bust of all time or the best, genius pick of in the draft.
Well, if history's any indicator, it's probably not going to work out. So everybody talks about, there's a lot of people who have been drafted as quarterback that weren't great in college or didn't play a lot that came in and had great NFL careers. Yeah, they were drafted in the fucking sixth round, guy.
Yeah.
Nobody traded up to three to get them unnecessarily, by the way. Jesus Christ.
It seemed like they were split, by the way. It felt like Shanahan and Lynch were split on it. It felt like Shanahan really wanted Trey Lance, and then Lynch wanted Mac Jones. Because we even had, who was it, Matt Leinhart? Matt Leinhart was on last week as well. And he's like, dude, I've got a source inside that office. All they have said is Mac Jones, the Mac front Jones, office. Mac Jones. Yeah. The front office.
Yeah, but then Shanahan.
Something happened there. I don't know what it was.
My people told me Shanahan wanted Trey Lance. So whatever he did, like if it doesn't work, fire or whatever. I don't know. Whatever, or maybe he showed them something compelling enough that made them change their mind. But man, that's a big risk for him personally. Holy shit.
Oh, yeah.
If that doesn't work out in 2 years, you're done.
Both of them are out. That's what happened to the Falcons. Coach, GM, all those guys are gone now.
Yeah.
Yeah. This reminds me, not to bring it back to, I was thinking about when I was doing this book and I was hanging around with all of these Air Force guys, and I couldn't get over the fact that the people at the top were incredibly impressive. Mm. And I was like, why is this institution, it seems to me, not alone among, well, one of the rare American institutions where the higher you go, the smarter people get without. And I realized it's because they're doing the opposite of what we're talking about. This is an organization that takes in, that takes chances on tens of thousands of people and puts them through round after round after round, essentially of competition, and then picks its winners. The guys who go to the, who are named chief of staff of the Air Force, they're 50 by the time they get to that point. So they have been subjected to a competition for 30 years. Mm-hmm. Now, if you want to, if you're willing to take your time, and if you're willing to expand the pool of applicants to thousands and thousands of people, then you will get, you absolutely will make a, the correct prediction about the right. It's when we constrain those two things that we run into trouble. And this is my, my broader philosophy about what I find frustrating about this country is the solution to a lot of our problems is to go the Air Force model, expand the Army model, expand the number of people who you give a chance to at the bottom. Mm-hmm.
So you're talking about a meritocracy, but also a high-volume meritocracy.
Right? I love high-volume meritocracies.
Yeah.
I say, instead of like being Harvard University and letting in 1,000 students a year, which is the most absurd thing in the world if you have $50 billion in the bank, why don't they let in 10,000 people a year? Or even 100,000. They can afford it. Why? They sit there making the same mistake these NFL teams do, which is they think they can predict from a pool of 18-year-olds, who's going to be the greatest graduate 4 years later? And you know what? You can't.
Right. Do you want to
say just take a shot at 10,000 kids and pick winners after 4 years?
It comes down to their what their goal is, though, right? Their goal is to maintain their prestige, not to necessarily benefit the country or education or society.
Yeah.
Obviously. Otherwise, they would do what you're saying. Because it wouldn't matter what the – like, well, we had a lot of people drop out after 2 years, so that looks bad for us. No, it doesn't. It looks like you have really high standards and a lot of people that you gave access to that didn't have before couldn't make the cut. And you proved your point.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But you also, in proving your point, generated a much higher volume of excellent, excellently educated people. That's a, that seems like a win-win to me. If you take your ego out of it and the prestige and all that old school bullshit, seems like it makes sense. But
do they do the same thing with Navy SEALs and BUDS?
If you can pass the requirements to try out, you can try out.
Yeah.
There's no there's no limitation on that shit. But the attrition rate is like 85-90%. Right?
Yeah.
So
I was reading,
by the way, they don't take that as an insult. Navy SEALs aren't sitting around like talking about how the prestige of their unit is lost. Their units are lost because of the high attrition rate. They're like, yeah, this was really fucking hard, and everybody here did it.
Yeah.
Every single person here, everybody I have to go to war with did the same goddamn thing I did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Doesn't that make sense? I mean, shit.
I think
high
so.
I love that phrase. High volume meritocracy.
It's yours.
Yeah.
No, it's yours.
Put it in your next book.
I want more high volume meritocracies. Yeah. I want to give everyone a shot because the only reason we don't give people a shot is that we think we can predict.
Mm.
And we can't. So give it up. Give it up. Give everyone a shot. Like, I don't know what the next, like in the Air Force, they don't know what the next Air Force chief of staff looks like. So they give 10,000 people a shot.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, if you think about the best gamblers in the world,
mm-hmm.
win somewhere between like 56 and 62% of their bets.
Yep. Yeah.
The best in the world do that.
Correct.
So, I mean, if you're an NFL GM and 60% of your fucking draft picks work out, that's pretty goddamn good, right?
Yeah.
But that is not the case.
Yeah, for sure.
That is certainly not the case. I mean, how many people get drafted every year? There's 7 rounds, 32 picks, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's like, what, 340-some people?
Yeah.
Every single year. And how many people are actually in the NFL that are starting and making an impact on a regular basis, right?
Yeah.
There's a draft every year. I mean, it's they're not hitting on these very frequently.
I tried it with gambling this year, by the way, because we have this gambling sponsor. So I was like, all right, if I bet on everything with the knowledge that I have, what would be the outcome? So I posted it in Drinking Bro Sports. I bet 468 different games, parlays, variations of whatever, right? I ended up coming out about $1,287 ahead at the end of it, which is great. Because I started with five, and I had already removed my $5,000, and that was my profit. Now, there was a certain point where I was up to, I had made $36,000. And what happened to me was I deviated from the system and I started throwing huge money on people that, like the Conor McGregor knockout or whatever. I didn't bet the same amount. I didn't do the same things. And it's possible. But this year I learned a lot about gambling where I was like, all right, cool, man. Just don't deviate from that system. And Dan's right. Like, yes, if you're just a little bit ahead, you're still better than everybody else and you can still win.
Right.
I don't know why more people don't do exactly what you're talking about with every other form of job in this
life. Well, it's because
they
want it fast, right? They don't want it right. They want it fast. And that's the problem. If there's a BUDS class, the Navy will fail 100% of those people if 100% of them are not qualified to do that job, right? That's what a fucking meritocracy is. It doesn't matter how you feel about it. There's a standard, and if you don't meet it, you're gone. The end. And it's, look, that's brutal, but life is fucking brutal, man. Ignoring that, what did Carl Sagan used to say? For me, it's better to grasp reality as it is rather than persist in delusion, no matter how gratifying. That's a pretty good thing to believe, to be honest. Because we just spend so much time deluding ourselves.
This reminds me of my favorite definition of a genius. A genius is not someone who has more good ideas than you or I. It's someone who has more ideas than you and I. They just generate. So they might have, if you and I might have two ideas, one's good, one's bad. A genius has 100 ideas, 50 are good and 50 are bad. Their ratio is not better. They just take more shots. They do. They take more shots, right? And that's every time I observe someone in a creative field who I think is worthy of admiration, that's what I see. I just see that they just take way. Like, we have a big audiobook coming up with the songwriter Paul Simon. And it's really sat down with him for like 40 hours and did all this conversation. It's incredible. And if you listen to him, he's been making world-class music since the 1950s. And he emailed me the other day and he's like, I just composed, I think one of my, you know, he's talking about some beautiful thing he just done that he was really proud of. And I was like, he's now in his late 70s. He's still composing beautiful music. I've listened to some of it. He just doesn't stop. He works harder than everyone else and refuses to give up. And he's had all kinds of, he'll be the first to tell you he has a lot of bad ideas, but he just has more ideas.
Yeah.
Once I realized that about, I was like, he is such a kind of role model for me. I'm like, I hope to be that way when I'm in my late 70s. I hope to be still trying, you know?
I hope so too. And that's the biggest thing that we talk about on the show of when you retire, when to not retire. Well, if you're a creative person, I don't know how you ever let go of that. I'm curious though, you brought up Paul Simon. He just sold his catalog maybe 3 weeks ago. Did he go into why in any of your interviews?
They're all doing it now. You know, Dylan just did it. I think that it's just a moment in the market where people are prepared to pay a lot of money, you know, because of streaming and all these kinds of things you're at the end, you're at a point in your life where it makes sense. I didn't ask him about it. I was like, I have a limited amount of time with this man. I'm not going to, money is not, it's not like the interesting thing with him.
It's not about the money. It's about the ownership. And I guess that's what I was more or less curious about, was the ownership. Because you take a guy like Prince refused to even have a will or anything. I mean, everything he had was locked down, and then he, you know, died too young without a will. And then it went to all these weird people and, you know, they're going through that every single day in a court. But
My understanding is you can sell the rights to your catalog and still retain some control over it. Right. So they sell them with I don't know whether he did this, but I know you can do this, that you sell it and you say, by the way, if you want to use any of my songs in a commercial, you got to ask me. I got to get permission.
Okay, cool.
So you can have restrictions.
I mean, now you can make your catalog an NFT, right?
Yeah, that's a whole nother thing. Are you guys working on any of that?
I mean, that
NFTs?
I don't understand that stuff. I'm sorry, I'm too old.
Just give up. But I mean, Paul, what did he get? Like $250 million for that catalog? Like, what is he going to do? Leave songs to his family, or is he going to leave $250 million to his family?
I 100% agree with it. I just, as an artist, you're always curious. as to what is more important and why and everything else.
Well, it sounds like he's still creating so much. He's not looking in the rearview mirror anymore.
Yeah, and look, I've got kids, so all I care about is the money. Like, dude, I'm going to sell all my shit. If I was that age, yeah, dude, I'd sell it all and then give it to them and be like, hey, go party, live a great life. Last question I wanted to ask you, since you are a huge sports guy and you're big into psychology and everything else, what is the hardest sport? Because we have this debate all the time on this show of what the hardest sport is to play in the world. In your opinion, what is it?
I guess I would say, whose accomplishments do I admire the most? Mm-hmm. There'll be a couple. Professional cyclists. I think what they do is insane.
I mean, the intensity over that amount of time is probably unmatched in any other kind of sport, to be honest.
The duration of it. Yeah. Like, I know Lance Armstrong a little bit. Mm. He's about as tough and as competitive a guy as I have. I mean, I just don't think there are a lot of people who can at that level. All those guys, all those cyclists are like that. And in my sport, obviously, marathoners, or particularly ultra marathoners, that's just, again, it's the duration. I can't wrap my mind around people who do things, who perform at a world-class level for 4, 5, 6 hours at a time.
Or that, sometimes even more, like that 235-mile race in Utah that they do every year. I don't know what the fuck it's called, but fuck that. No way I'm doing that.
Yeah. And maybe the one that's number one, though, which doesn't fit into that category is, this is going to surprise you, ballet dancers. Mm. If you've ever had a conversation with a ballet dancer, what they do is insane. Mm-hmm. Do you know how much they practice? Hours and hours and hours. And then they do this and they have little slippers on their feet. I mean, they're jumping up and down. They're performing acrobatic feats that would blow your mind. They're lifting each other and throwing each other around. I mean, the whole thing is just nuts. Mm-hmm. And they're doing it in front of an audience that will catch even the slightest mistake. It has to be perfect every time out. Like that, those guys I have insane amount of respect for.
Have you ever read the book Choke by Siim Balog? I think it's her name. She talks about like choking in sports and other kind of performance and stuff. It's really good.
I once wrote a New Yorker article on choking. It was all about Greg Norman's famous meltdown at the Masters. And I was trying to understand how that happened.
Right.
Part of it is Nick Faldo is a stone cold killer, and you try you go up against him on day four of the Masters. Good luck. Mm. I wouldn't have lunch with Nick Faldo. He would steal my fries and I wouldn't even notice it. Like, but it was like, it's a fascinating, if you watch the video of that final of Norman's final round, I guess it's 87. I forget what year it is. It's just unreal. Your heart goes out to him. I mean, he goes from being the greatest golfer in the world to a guy who cannot hit a single thing in the space of 10 minutes.
Yeah, I as a kid, I was watching it, and I remember my father's reaction to it, and he was like, oh, no, oh, no.
Oh, yeah.
And then as an adult, I was at the Super Bowl, the 28-3 game, where you couldn't believe it. And as a Falcons fan, I could not believe what I was seeing.
It's like quicksand.
It felt like a video game going on. I knew the ending, and I couldn't do anything to stop it. There was at one point where I said, if I was down on the front row of that field, I would have jumped over and just yelled at Shanahan to run the fucking ball. And I still have like weird dreams that happened. I get arrested, but every Falcons fan forever is just like, thank you for doing that. He didn't understand that he couldn't run the ball. And then some nude guy ran out on the field and said, run the fucking ball, and got tackled, got arrested. Because it would have given them, I've thought about this so many times in my mind, it would have taken 15 minutes for them to get me off the field at the Super Bowl. It would have forced everybody to reevaluate what they were doing offensively. And they probably would have run the fucking ball, but I was in a suite, man. And I fucked it up and I ruined it for my city. And I never think about that again. Greatest athlete is PDW, by the way.
You're being an idiot right now, but there might be something to that. The ability to pause and hit Alt F4 and whatever, just clear your fucking random access memory for a second and go back to scratch. What would I do right now if I was in this situation and all this stuff hadn't happened to get me there.
Well,
forget about all that.
But it did happen in a Super Bowl. Remember when the lights went out and the 49ers were able to regroup against the Ravens and then they made that big comeback. They ultimately lost, but it came down to that last play in the end zone where they could have won because they regrouped and they were probably the better team that year.
But I don't think there's any formula that you could activate to accomplish this. You can either do shit like that or you can't. Michael Jordan can create reasons for him to be angry at the other team that they're not even aware of to motivate himself internally. And if he needs to wipe his mind right quick, he can do that. People like that can do it. I don't think you can teach. Some you could probably teach some things, but not that, I don't think.
No. And Pete Weber Jr., the bowler, that's the greatest athlete of all time. Yeah. I love it.
Oh, yeah.
Who you think you are, I am, is the easily the best flex of all time.
I remember that. That's so fantastic.
Best flex of all time. And he said it after winning a match live on air to the dude's face, and it was just the greatest. Malcolm, this is the point in the show we get to the drinking bro of the week, which is someone who has inspired you or helped you become the person you are today. Who would you like to give the drinking bro of the week to?
Oh, my goodness. I would like to give it to my business partner, Jacob Weisberg, who I have known for 30 years and is who I have discovered at this point in my life is the most brilliant businessman, in addition to being a fantastic person, that I've ever known. So, Jacob Weisberg, drinking bro.
Awesome. Get that bag. Get that bag, Malcolm. Mm-hmm. Proud of you. Proud of you. Look, you have a standing invitation to come back. This was absolutely fantastic. We really enjoyed having you today. Thank you for your time. Go check out his new book, The Bomber Mafia. Now that I know that the audiobook has got actual clips of everybody in it, get the audiobook. Mm-hmm. I was pushing McConaughey's audiobook. We're going to push this. Go get Malcolm's new audiobook.
And get it from his website, bombermafia.com. Don't buy it from Audible. Come on.
You get more money if you buy it from the website to the authors. So do that. Please do that. Malcolm, thank you for being with us again today. For D'Anthony Holloway, I am Ross Patterson. Good night.